Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Roberto Tejadas is the author of a poetry collection, Full Foreground, Exposition Park, and Mirrors for Gold. He founded and co-edited Mandorla, New Writing for From the Americas, a journal of poetry in translation. He is the Hugh Roy and Lily Kranz Cullen Distinguished Professor at the University of Houston, where he teaches in the Creative Writing Program and Art History Department. He is with us to talk about his brand new book, Still Nowhere in an Empty Vastness. It is a collection of essays and manifestos. I think it's more when you have more than one manifesto in your life. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Roberto to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. Very glad to be here.
Well, this is a beautiful book. It is, it's a paperback. It is, I'm struck by how it is laid out because it's very pretty. And I am curious as to how long this has been in the making.
Well, the book, I'm glad you noticed the design because it was designed by a fellow poet friend of mine, Douglas Kearney, who really understood the book and sort of created a design that comments on the essays themselves. Some of these essays go back 27 years ago, and as I was putting them together in 2016, I began to realize that many of these essays that I'd written independently and as sort of discrete works began to have a kind of coherence that really struck me as responding to the present, or at least speaking back and forth between the past and the present, especially in an election year, that year in which we had a candidate who was maligning Latin America and Mexico in particular and other peoples. It seemed to me important to speak to the relationship, the long relationship between the Americas and especially between the United States and Mexico and Cuba.
The first sentence in the book, the very first sentence, is a question, which is, what does it mean to engage in advanced poetic language of authentic interest and public imperative? That is a lot to start off with.
Yes. I think that the answer came to me as well in many of the other essays. And I think that each essay, in a sense, or each of the artists and writers that I follow, and really what I'm telling are stories, that in a sense, what that imperative is about what does it mean to be on a map? And as U.S. citizens, what does it mean to be in a map that sometimes only configures the United States? And so what I'm thinking of is precisely how to think of citizenship, belonging, selfhood, personhood in relation to the hemisphere or the Americas. And therefore, I follow these stories that go back to the 17th century and up to the present.
So when you write, rehearsed in this book is the conflict, your conflict with an uncritical U.S.-centric avant-garde, sectarian nativism, and the inclination to territorialize. What do you mean by that specifically?
In part, in what I mentioned, but I'll develop that, which is that I often feel that that some of the writing practices in the United States tend to look domestically or in the interior. And I guess I'm interested in those writers and those artists who think about the U.S. and its complicities in what we might call the uneven distribution of modern life, which the avant-garde has been invested in as early as the 20th century.
How do you define the avant-garde?
I would define it broadly as the culture of critique, and that those artists, particularly in the early 20th century in Mexico and the United States, were thinking about social projects as well, oftentimes utopian. And so I think one of my disappointments is when the social project or this the dreaming that often comes with the avant-garde is replaced by a kind of specialist or an expertise, a kind of technocratic expertise. And or one of its other versions is a kind of distrust of the human. The Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset spoke of the dehumanization of art. And I often feel that some aspects of the avant-garde are uncomfortable with the messiness that is the human subject and the human body.
In a chapter entitled Avant-Garde in Crisis, you write, "Inasmuch as I've lost faith in the sustainability of an avant-garde as a definable formation, especially in an expanding media environment of overproduction and calculated obsolescence, I want writing to reimagine citizenship today in terms that include a voluptuousness of the self and its overcast contingencies." By the way, that's a beautiful sentence. You don't need me to say that, but it's a beautiful sentence. So when it comes to your hopes for writing, I'd like to get into the media aspect as well. But when it comes to the writing, how do we reimagine? How would you envision that reimagining?
So I'm thinking precisely now of that, of the mid-20th century Cuban modernist poet José Lezama Lima, who I've translated. And to address your question about the media aspect, he has this wonderful phrase that he says that a poem is a photograph of breathing. And so what I'm imagining, and I often turn to Lezama Lima as somebody who, as an inspiration, because I think what he was able to coalesce is both a kind of exuberance, this voluptuousness that I speak about, which has to do with the body, but has to do also with the flora and fauna particular to the tropical island of Cuba. It's the possibility of combining both the exorbitant rhetoric of, say, 16th and 17th century Spanish poetry, which he did, and the warping of surrealist poetry. So he's able to combine these various traditions and archives into a particular kind of work. And to me, that seems to me a pathway for writing in English.
I know it's not a competition, but "a poem is a photograph of breathing" is a pretty kick-ass sentence as well.
It does say a lot about what we expect from a line and how it can also have a kind of representational quality just in the terms of its sonic qualities.
I don't mean to overload on this, but there is the static quality of the photograph, which does not change, does not move, but obviously breathing is that. And there's poetry itself, which in this form can be pretty much anything.
Yes, and I think also what might be an interesting thing to think about as well is in the way that a photograph is as interesting for what it doesn't include as what it does include, we could say something similar to breath or the poetic imagination.
So when it comes to the media, when it comes to culture, when it comes to Hollywood, you write about that in the book, when it comes to these forces, these are really large things to go up against, aren't they?
Yes, and I try to make parallels between the past and the present. So, for example, you are probably pointing to the essay in which I discuss the ways in which the U.S. film industry was responding in part to the Mexican photography explosion that happened during the Mexican Revolution. There was the work of Victor Agustin Casasola, who was taking photographs, he and his brothers, and amassing an archive of other photographers as the revolution was taking place. These images are seen by U.S. American artists and writers, as well as the film industry. And the film industry, especially the Mutual Film Company, contracts the northern insurgent Francisco Villa, Pancho Villa, to restage many of his raids and his battles that were taking place on the border between the United States and Mexico. And it was interesting to see the ways in which the U.S. government would either align with Pancho Villa, as it seemed to at the beginning, but then when the U.S. Retaliates by recognizing Pancho Villa's arch enemy, Venustiano Carranza, then the film industry no longer depicts Pancho Villa as a kind of Robin Hood hero, but rather as a kind of brutal savage. And this is not unlike the ways in which the film industry or the media represents Latinos or Latinx peoples today. And so I'm thinking of another chapter later on where I speak of the contemporary photographer and wordsmith, Harry Gamboa Jr., and he recuperates this idea of how Latinx peoples, in his case Latinx men, have been represented, and he creates this large archive of photographs he's taken of artists, writers, his Chicano Male Unbonded series.
So the reflections in the media, the reflections in Hollywood, as you write in talking about the Mexican Revolution, because you have the Mexican Revolution, that's coinciding with the rise of the U.S. film industry. There is a reflection, but there is also an altering, as you just mentioned, of that image, that it changes. Does it change the perception? Does it have an impact on what is perceived as the history to be?
I mean, I think that these histories get replicated or mirrored in these particular ways, but it's not always so one-sided. So mm-hmm. that what I want to have are images of artists and writers who really want to honor what they're seeing in Mexico, for example. I'm thinking of, there's a longest chapter at the beginning in which I look at, for example, in the early 20th century, during this effervescence of Mexican culture that took place after the Mexican Revolution, often called the Renaissance, you have artists like the photographer Edward Weston, the poet Kenneth Rexroth, you have Langston Hughes, Catherine M. Porter, going to Mexico, often being participant witnesses of the cultural effervescence itself. And so these artists represent this other culture in ways that are honorific, I would say, that want to change the ways in which the U.S. has perceived of Mexico. There's an interesting figure as well. She was Mexican-born of U.S. parents and then trained and studied in Texas, Anita Brenner, and she's written a really interesting history of the Mexican Revolution using just photographs called The Wind That Swept Mexico. And she published for very mass media journals like Harper's Magazine, for example.
You have a chapter in the book which I thought was so fascinating. It's an essay on Elian Gonzalez, and you talk about, it's called Elian Through the Looking Glass. I think most of us remember that, and probably, maybe in many cases, and I found this in reading your book, that probably don't remember it correctly. But it can show how I assume, both in some cases enlightening, in other cases hurtful, in the image that we have of the problems, right? Of again, that a news story like this that is used to kind of capture what an issue is doesn't really do it justice.
I think that's right, and I'm struck how that the story now changes from our viewpoint of the present. So on the one hand, what I was writing that essay as the episodes were taking place, and it now seems like the distant past, but this was a moment in really which the 24-hour news feed was something very novel and new. The ways in which the press, both the printed press and the news media, the television media, were covering this really seemed to me to be eclipsed, in the one hand, by this one particular image, which I reprint in the book, an award-winning image by the AP photographer Alan Diaz, in which the power of the state comes in to basically seize Elian from his great uncle's house, Lázaro. And on the one hand, I think today we look at that and see how invested was the U.S. in keeping a child, the boy delivered by the sea, as he was often called, for the sake of democracy. And yet today we have children in cages on the border who are being denied this possibility of belonging. And so to me this strikes me as particular. If we look back as well during the Elian Gonzalez episode and after, it's really the first time that what we might call Latinidad, or an understanding of Latinx peoples, begins to mainstream in the United States. And thereafter, there's this surge of sort of advertising and commercialism that's geared toward Latinx consumers.
The book is fascinating. It is still nowhere in an empty vastness. Roberto, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
really, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.